Okay, I have received the necessary signal that we should get going. So welcome everyone. Once again, this webinar is called IRA and its Critics, Breaking Down the Establishment's Favorite Definition of Anti-Semitism. It's being brought to you by Partners for Progressive Israel, and it is the latest installment of Partners for Progressive Israel's webinar series called Conversations with Israel and Palestine, which bring voices from Israel and Palestine to an American and international audience and provide an important link between progressives in the Middle East and those in the US and around the world. My name is Ron Skolnick. I organize these webinars on behalf of Partners for Progressive Israel. I'll just have a few words before we get going. I'll note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit organization. It is dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and that includes an end to Israel's 55-year occupation based on a two-state solution. Partners supports Israelis working to ensure social justice, civil rights, and equality for all of Israel's inhabitants, and those who are working to cultivate Jewish-Arab partnerships. Partners seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's and Palestine's complexities so they can better advocate for a progressive future for all the inhabitants of the region. Now, Partners, as you know, you didn't have to pay anything, so Partners is bringing this webinar for free, but if you enjoy it and want to support programming like this, please visit progressiveisrael.org and make your way to the donation page. Quick note about upcoming programming. First and foremost, Partners for Progressive Israel is again holding online its annual Israel-Palestine Symposium. That's a 7-Sunday series of gatherings and meetings and webinars from October 23 to December 18. So please keep a lookout on social media and via email for further details. In addition, we're looking forward to a webinar later this month in partnership with Hashomer HaTzair on that organization's relief efforts for Ukrainian refugees. And for September, we're planning a webinar that will bring together representatives of two different approaches to an Israel-Palestine confederation. And again, please be on the lookout for details. One sad note, I need to mention that Professor Amos Goldberg, who was supposed to join us, is not going to be able to do so today due to a death in the family. He shares his apologies and we of course express our deepest condolences. Abruptly, I have to now move over to introducing our panel in brief. I'm going to be putting their full bios in the chat and just giving you a few highlights so that we can get to what you've arrived for. Professor Amal Jamal is faculty member of the School of Political Science, Government and International Affairs at Tel Aviv University. He's currently head of the Walter Liebach Institute for the Study of Jewish-Arab Coexistence at Tel Aviv University and is co-editor of the leading Hebrew political science journal, The Public Sphere. Professor Jamal's scholarly interests include political theory, politics and culture, political communication, and civil society. And he is currently working on a book manuscript on the politics of Palestinian culture in Israel for Cambridge University Press. Joshua Shaines is professor of Jewish studies and director of the Arnold Center for Israel Studies at the College of Charleston. He's published widely on modern Jewish politics, culture, and religion, as well as anti-Semitism and contemporary politics. And you can find his writings in both academic and popular outlets, such as Slate, The Washington Post, Haaretz, and The Forward. He's currently completing a book on Jewish orthodoxy from its German origins through the 21st century, and has just recently become a new board member of Partners for Progressive Israel. Last, certainly not least, Stacey Burdett has been a trusted resource on countering anti-Semitism for office holders and thought leaders across the political spectrum since the 1990s. She worked with corporations, nonprofits, and officials on strategies to fight anti-Semitism and bigotry. She served as ADL's Vice President for Government Relations, Advocacy, and Community Engagement, and she represented ADL at the 2001 UN World Conference Against Racism in Durban. She's also served as Government and External Relations Director at the US Holocaust Memorial Museum, and she has worked relevant to today's discussion with the drafters of both the IRA definition of anti-Semitism as well as the Nexus document and the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism, and we'll be learning more about all of those. So thank you for your patience. Let me hand things over now to Professor Shaines. I'll be back at the end to wrap things up. and enjoy the webinar.
Thank you so much, Ron, and welcome everyone. I'm really honored to be here. I'm sorry that Amos couldn't be with us, but I'm looking very much forward to the conversation. Towards the end of each round of questions, I will sort of step in a bit to make a contribution that I think Amos would support, sort of give his view, and I'll explain what that means a little bit later. I want to let everyone know the Q&A function is open. The chat box is also open, but I'm mostly ignoring that. If you have questions you would like the panelists to speak to, please type them into the Q&A box. You don't have to wait for the second half of the program when we get to those questions. You can type them in as they occur to you. I can't promise we'll get to each one, but I'll try to group them together in some sort of vaguely intelligent way that gets to as many as possible. I'm also going to now put into the chat box two links that I think are important for everyone to have. One is to the IRA definition itself, which is easy to find. You can also just Google IRA antisemitism. And the other is to the Jerusalem Declaration on Antisemitism, which I imagine is going to come up in conversation. I think it's very important for people to be looking at primary sources. All of us who teach believe in that, I'm sure. So it's important for all of you who are home on a computer screen, if you can pull those up, I think it'll be helpful. So the agenda is as follows. I'm going to say I've been tasked with saying just a few words introducing what IRA is and how I come to it. And then I'm going to pass the baton to our other panelists to give a little more background about how they came to it and what IRA does or doesn't do for them. Just as a way of background, my own training I'm an academic. I've trained in anti-Semitism and nationalism and modern Jewish politics. And my own disposition is therefore coming from that perspective, not necessarily for fighting anti-Semitism, but rather for trying to understand it. Paradoxically, a lot of academics you'll find are actually uncomfortable with definitions altogether. One of the reasons for this is because we're very influenced by a very particular essay, which may come up in conversation, by Professor David Engel some 15 years ago, wrote an article called Away from a Definition of Anti-Semitism, where he argued that definitions, no matter how you do it, are going to be too problematic to use. I actually heard a month ago from one of his former grad students, he actually banned his graduate students from ever using the term in any of their papers because he wanted to instill in them the complexity of the subject and the need to be specific of its context in any given point. In any event, today we'll be talking about the famous IHRA definition, IHRA definition of antisemitism. The IHRA definition goes back now almost 20 years. I'm sure Stacey Burdett will speak to it as she was involved in its construction back in the day and its use. Its lead author was Ken Stern, who's now at Bard College, where he runs a Center for Hate Studies. And it was produced by Ken when he was at the AJC, who was tasked with trying to come up with some sort of definition that Europeans in particular could use to try to gather data on anti-Semitism. And you can all, I hope, look, if you haven't yet done so, click on the link I gave you. So you can see the so-called working definition. Over time, this definition that was used for data collection started becoming, I'm trying to use a word that's not judgmental, used for legislative purposes. The word that its opponents called is weaponized. It's a word that Ken Stern has used. I'm sure there's a neutral way of saying that, but it has become weaponized in this way to try to arm people who want to stop anti-Semitism, people like Stacey Burdett. Ken himself later came out against this. He wrote a book, which I recommend, called The Conflict Over the Conflict, an excellent book, which talks about his sort of value of academic freedom and his opposition to any sort of legislation of his definition. In response to that, a lot of people then said, well, you know, Ken wasn't so important in writing the definition. Maybe he wasn't even the lead author. He's exaggerating because his narrative didn't necessarily work. The biggest effort in response to the IHRA definition came out a year or two ago, called the Jerusalem Declaration on Antisemitism, which I also gave you a link for that. This would have been discussed by Amos, but maybe at the end of the round, I'll make a few comments about it in place of Amos. The JDA sought to refine and work on the so-called working definition of IHRA to build on what it thought it got right. and to improve on things it thought it got wrong. I'll speak more about that later on, but I just wanted to give some background to what we're talking about. I think for our first round, people might want to know, what is your background in with connection to anti-Semitism and your specific relationship with the IHRA definition? I'll throw that out there and turn it over to Stacy.
Thank you so much, Josh. This debate is really fascinating because it draws in so many different questions that we need to be examining. It pulls in so many groups of stakeholders. And to me, this debate, although it's been acrimonious at times, at the end of this debate, if we conduct the debate productively and responsively, we will have more people invested in the fight against anti-Semitism, and we will have more people invested in protecting important space for debate, critique, and advocacy for pro-Palestinian speech and for reasoned criticism. So this debate doesn't feel extremely comfortable right now. It poses a lot of uncomfortable questions, but there's a potential outcome that's going to be very constructive for a diverse group of people. So I'm hopeful. So Josh, you asked about the origin of the IHRA definition. And one of the most important things to remember about the origin of the definition is that we were a group of people trying to solve a very urgent problem in the middle of a crisis. It's not that the IHRA definition doesn't include concepts and principles that should have a long shelf life. It's just, I'm a practitioner, not a scholar, but I think historians do this too. You have to look at the mindset of who created something, who wrote something. And the IHRA definition, you know, Professor Erwin Kotler, who I really respect and I'm so privileged to know, has come to talk about the IHRA definition as being born of a democratic process. And Professor Kotler has it a bit backwards, because the original crafting of the IHRA definition included extremely smart stakeholders, thoughtful people, practitioners, European Union monitoring experts, and people like Ken Stern, whose book is fantastic if people haven't read it. But I wouldn't say that it was a process that fully looked 20 years into the future. And that's okay. Let me explain what was happening at the time. Jewish community leaders were trying to advocate for protection for Jewish communities who were facing a big surge in violence. And in order to get a response from law enforcement, from all kinds of first responders, you have to quantify a problem. And governments in Europe, and famously the European Union, was commissioned a report about anti-Semitism in Europe, and they threw the report in the trash because the report spoke about anti-Semitism that was connected to hostility to Zionism in Israel. That's a very, very urgent problem for a group of advocates and good faith partners in government institutions. That's an urgent problem to solve. People are getting beaten. People are targets of violence. It's not being seen or quantified. I think about hate crimes against Black people in places like Russia that are routinely categorized as drunken hooliganism. So there is not a sufficient response. So the group of people, it includes scholars from Israel, it included people in organizations like ADL, where I was, who put together, I think, a very robust definition that was trying to achieve something very pointed. The purpose of the definition was to raise a red flag and say, when a Jewish community center is targeted with anti-Israel graffiti, or when an anti-Israel protest that is turning so hostile and violent is in front of a synagogue instead of in front of an Israeli consulate, that is targeting Jews and just using another excuse to target them. So, and we do see a spike in violence against Jews whenever there is a military confrontation between the IDF and Hamas. And so that the IRA definition meant to say, if you're upset with Israel, if you see human rights violations or you read about them, beating up your Jewish neighbor's daughter, like a little girl in Brussels was beaten senseless, that's not political speech, that's hate violence. So it was a very commendable purpose. And I think we need to be mindful that IRA was not drafted to squelch speech. It was really trying to protect people. And I think a good majority of the wording in IRA is a useful tool to do that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Amal.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm glad to be here. And as a matter of fact, I wondered why I was actually from the beginning invited to such a talk, and whether this talk regarding antisemitism, which is had to be recognized as a widespread phenomena in different places worldwide, especially in Western countries, in Europe and in North America. And yes, there is, to an extent, confusion between Israel and Zionism and Jews, the Jewish people in different places. And I fully agree with what has been said, that this confusion is shouldn't happen and is not legitimate at all. So the issue is whether antisemitism is a Jewish issue, has to do with Jews, and Jews has to discuss it, debate it, and find a way out to fight antisemitism. Was actually, it's a humanistic and much broader topic that we have to deal with. And I think I'm from those who say racism is a racism, no matter whether it's against Jews or Blacks or any other group worldwide. And therefore, it has to be fought and engaged against whenever possible. So from the start, we have to put on the table that when we speak about antisemitism, living in Israel, being an Israeli myself, a Palestinian Israeli, but still living in Israel, of course, I am very sensitive to to racism, and definitely aware of antisemitism in Europe, having lived in Europe for several years, especially in Germany and of course in the US. So the engagement with antisemitism is an issue that I view it at least from a broader point of view, from the point of view of racism, and despite the fact that antisemitism was somehow acquired to mean anti-Jewish hatred or bad feelings, I think it's still a certain type of racism that we have to tackle. And at our point, actually, when you reduce racism into antisemitism, actually we downgrade the danger of the phenomena to an extent, especially when it is related to Zionism and Israel. And I'll come to that in a minute. I think we have to be aware that antisemitism, no matter how and in what way it is expressed, it's illegitimate, it should be denied, it should be condemned. Having said that, I think the IRA definition, poses a problem. And I agree with those who say definitions are always problematic, especially when we try actually to define a very complex phenomena that manifests itself in endless forms and endless ways. So when you try to define such a phenomena as antisemitism, actually you have to be reductive. You have to reduce it somehow and try to pinpoint it in a certain way. Having said that, again, I wonder when I read the IRA definition, whether people who define it in this form know English well, speak English. Like, I read it several times, many times, and I wonder all the time why it was defined in this form. I mean, is there a language problem, or there were intentions behind this definition that actually empty the definition itself from any practical meaning, or have actually political intentions behind it rather than fighting anti-Semitism. I wonder, of course, I'm posing questions, because when you read it, you are stunned that it's such a broad definition that includes everything, and as a result doesn't include anything, that you can actually apply it to any phenomena that is criticizing whatever Jews do. Certain anti-Semitic phenomenon that has to be tackled, somehow viewed as not only unacceptable, but also delegitimized. So that's why when you speak about this inclusiveness of the definition, we have to go actually to the examples given in order to better understand what is meant behind it. And here we face a much greater problem. I think the problem that we face through the definition itself is even made greater when we go to the examples given in order to explicate what is meant by the definition. And here we actually have an answer as to the intentions of people being involved in this definition, whether, by the way, consciously or unconsciously, because as we say, people say in Hebrew, kavanot tovot movilot gehinom, like good intentions can lead to hell. I'm sure there were good intentions behind it. I'm sure, and I fully understand the need for tackling the challenge. But when you give certain examples to this definition, this broad definition, you narrow it to manifestations that reveal part of the subconscious intentions that are embedded in the definition. Whether people intended them or not, it doesn't matter. Or I say it also differently, that people have been using this definition, this broad definition, in order actually to delegitimize freedom of speech, to delegitimize certain critique of conducts by Jews, in this case, Jews in Israel, as if this critique is anti-Semitic. Because when we look at the definition, we have to understand there is something anti-Semitic in the definition of anti-Semitism. Because what do you mean? How do you relate to Jews then? Jews are human beings that can make mistakes and should be criticized for making mistakes. Or Jews are human beings that make decisions and should be carried responsible, as responsible with decisions. When you try to put Jews as extraterritorial group through the examples you give, then wait a minute, aren't you actually reiterating anti-Semitic sentiments? Aren't you putting a huge burden on Jews by this definition? Especially by the examples you give, and I will stop on one example or two only. One, of course, is the mentioning the state of Israel in one of the examples. The moment you actually give an example of criticizing the state of Israel as an example of anti-Semitism, then it becomes a political definition. How can you fight anti-Semitism with such a definition that not only violates the right of people to criticize a state like the state of Israel, but also make their critique illegitimate, shrinking actually the freedom of expression, and accusing Jews to be using this definition in order to limit the freedom of expression. Aren't you actually putting Jews in an impossible position when you use this definition and give an example like Kitzain, the state of Israel? This is one thing. The other thing, the other example, and really, I know I should be short. The second example is double standards. The example of the double standards. I mean, for God's sake, if you are talking about double standards, how can people relate actually to the support that many Jewish communities worldwide are giving the state of Israel, despite what the state of Israel is conducting in the occupied Palestinian territories? How? I mean, how the double standards is, where is this double standard actually? Isn't it in the Jewish communities and many Jewish communities supportive of Israel? And despite the fact that I will leave it open, you know, this support, and won't criticize it, but still, if, when you speak about the double standards, many of these Jewish communities are supporting Israel, notwithstanding what is being done in their name in this case. So who is practicing double standards? The anti-Semitic people, or actually those who are defining the anti-Semitism in such a broad way, revealing their intentions of trying to shrinking the spaces of freedom of expression in this regard when it comes to Israel. And last point is concerning the conflict. I mean, when it comes to Palestinian voices and, you know, being Palestinian inside Israel, looking at this strong Israeli state and what is it's practicing, how do you want me to relate actually to this state? In what way? When I, of course, I'm very cautious personally, and I wish everybody to be cautious not to depict the Jewish majority in inherent terms that turn them into, turn their critique against their politics and their policies anti-Semitic. Definitely we should be cautious. But on the other hand, when you look at public opinion in Israel and what the policies that are being supported by the majority of the Jewish majority in Israel, then, you know, any critique of the politics carried out by the Israeli state or the Jewish majority could be, within this framework of this definition, could be viewed, could be framed as anti-Semitic. So aren't we, why not criticizing Jews? Yeah, I have the right to criticize Jews for what they are doing. They are human beings, and they are to be carried responsible for what they do, and I'm not anti-Semitic. I don't have to be anti-Semitic in this case, because yeah, it is the Jewish majority carrying out policies that are very problematic, to an extent that put them in a place that I think they should look at themselves and ask themselves whether they are not in their policies encouraging speech that could be could become very close to be anti-Semitic. It doesn't mean that we legitimize anti-Semitism, but still we have the right to criticize those who are actually supporting policies in the name of the Jewish people, supported by Jewish communities in Europe and North America.
Mal, can I cut in? Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that. You actually anticipated a couple later questions and combined them into one answer, which I appreciate for conciseness. Because of the hour, I know that there's going to be already questions coming in. Amos is not with us because of, unfortunately, the loss in his family. I'd like to just represent, as best of my ability, just for a minute or two, what I think would have been his presentation, and then give Stacey a chance, and she's been so involved with this for so many years, to respond to some of the things Amal said. Amos was one of the main authors of the Jerusalem Declaration. And I just want to say, as an academic, it was composed by academic scholars of anti-Semitism from Israel, the United States, and Europe, and signed by a couple hundred of those scholars. And there are, by the way, also excellent scholars who prefer the Eimer definition. And I encourage everyone, as I do my students, to Google and Google and Google and find all of these articles defending IRA and defending the JDA, or disliking both or loving both. And so you can judge for yourself beyond this 1 hour we have today. But I think the idea is as follows. We sort of know, scholars, and I think outsiders, and I think probably Amal and Stacey will agree with me even, and everyone, maybe most of you at home, we know what anti-Semitism is to a large extent, right? In other words, a conspiracy theory that imagines Jews constituting a single global organism which is conspiring with various powers, nefarious powers, secret powers, banks, media, whatever it may be, to somehow destroy the world, led by some sort of international Jew. And I often tell my students, one shortcut to think about is if somebody says something about Israel, and I'll get in a moment why was Amal and others talking about Israel so much, is there a reason for that? If someone talks about Israel in a way that you could pop out Israel and say Rothschild, like they did 100 years ago, or I guess Rothschild's making a comeback now with some American politicians. But if you can pop out Israel and say Rothschild or George Soros or anything like that, and the sentence or image still works, you have anti-Semitism, right? In other words, you have this conspiracy where if you say Israel is responsible for Russia invading Ukraine, Israel is responsible for global warming, Israel is responsible for slavery in America, or whatever it may be, a conspiracy theory that is completely disconnected from reality, but that assumes a global Jew, or you assume that Jews in America are controlling Israel, right? Israel does this, a Jew in America is responsible. That's anti-Semitism. And really, there's widespread acceptance of this fact. There's widespread agreement about this. And if you read the IRA definition, that certainly doesn't focus on that, but it brings that out. And if you read the Jerusalem Declaration, as Amos would be doing right now if you were here, it brings that out. I think what it comes down to, why does IRA spend so much time talking about Zionism? And why does Jerusalem Declaration spend so much time responding to that? It's because that's the crux of it. That's where the disagreement is. Not because that's where all of the anti-Semitism is, far from it, especially in the United States, but that's where the disagreement is. And by the way, even there's not necessarily disagreement, because between IRA and the Jerusalem Declaration, both statements, and I think most scholars will agree, if you imagine a global Jewish conspiracy with Israel as the representative of that conspiracy, you have anti-Semitism. The question becomes, when you are saying things critical of Israel or critical of Zionism that do not tap that mythology, and does not tap that mythology, right? Does not talk about a global Jewish conspiracy. In that case, is it anti-Semitic? And in general, IRA, which is, because it is so sort of vague about this, it opens by saying a certain perception of Jews, right? It's so general about this, it can be used against criticism of Israel that is not grounded in this mythology. And the Jerusalem Declaration doesn't like that. It does not want to include criticism of a state, whether it's right or wrong. The criticism could be wrong. It doesn't make it anti-Semitic. It might just be wrong, or it might be right. That's the distinction I think that Amos would emphasize between the two definitions. And some of the better defenses of the two statements, I think, sort of focus in on that. I'll give you just a couple examples. One was Amal mentioned the double standard. Double standard could be something that's really problematic, right? Why is somebody who's living in, I don't know, Wyoming so obsessed with Israel? Well, it's an interesting question. Of course, Jews also seem obsessed about Israel. The problem with that is, unless you have a hierarchy of global concerns and divide up your time exactly proportionally, you're subject to the accusation of double standard. And that's just not how people work, right? The Americas, for example, was very obsessed with South Africa in the 80s, or for that matter, Soviet Jews in the 70s, and neither of those were the only atrocities happening on Earth. But those spoke to us, right? So when you have a country like Israel with that half the population of half the species of the human race thinks it has holy places and gets all this support from the United States, it's going to get attention. So that's one example of an elastic issue that could be used problematically. And there are others as well. So that's sort of, I think, what Amos would present. And we can speak more about that maybe during the Q&A, but I know Stacey wants to jump in and speak to a lot of this herself.
Thank you, Josh. I mean, I think the questions that are coming in are terrific, and we can jump to answering some of them, because one thing I will say is that we get lost in talking about anti-Semitism as having multiple forms. And we get so mired in trying to debate the multiple forms and the parameters of those forms that we forget the central organizing principle of anti-Semitism, which is it's a lie, it's a conspiracy theory. And the same parameters of anti-Semitism exist in so many different forms. One person asked, if you substitute the word Israel for Jew, well, yes, that can. Racism and hatred always has code switching. It has code words. White nationalists, they speak in codes. So yes, when anti-immigrant speech speaks in codes, and there are instances when the anti-Semitic metaframe of a conspiracy is superimposed and used about Israel. An example would be, you know, notions that Israel knew about 9/11 or planned 9/11, or all the Jews stayed home, or the Mossad was involved. And that really is, for that questioner, is a good metaframe. And Josh, if it's okay, maybe I'll just start with a couple of the questions and then bat it back to you guys.
Yes, absolutely. All the panelists, you can all see the questions, and please feel free to jump in and combine.
Right. So one person asked, are there instances in which anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism? Yes. I'm raising a child who believes that all ethno-nationalism should be opposed. So of course there are. It's just anti-Zionism is a proxy word for a number of different kinds of ideas. And it's sometimes hatred of Zionism is a proxy for hatred of Jews. And there are a narrow amount of times when it's not. Anti-Zionism can also be used, and again, there Amal can speak to this, but there are groups of people for whom Zionism has challenged their rights or their rights to self-determination and is in tension with their narrative. But when we see, as we've seen sometimes in coalitions, you know, where or clubs on college campuses, if a Jew can only join a club or a movement if they renounce their Zionism, that's discrimination against Jews simply because Zionism is part of most Jewish people's identity. So that's a tool of exclusion. It's discrimination. And you know, no one's asked the fundamental question, which is, do we need definitions to fight bigotry? And the answer is no. We need training, we need understanding, we need awareness. And law enforcement officers, monitors need these kinds of documents. I urge people to read all three of the definitions because they mostly agree. They agree on the most important things that policymakers or first responders need to know. That anti-Semitism is dangerous, that it's rooted in lies and conspiracy theories, and that sometimes anti-Semitism can use Zionism and Israel as reference points, and that you got to look at the context for these cases and you need training around it. And all three of the definitions are good training tools. Zero of them belong codified in policy for all of the reasons. And one questioner even talked about how this conversation is confusing. And imagine a police officer in a small town needing to understand a policy. The county where I live in Maryland wants to adopt the IRA definition. And like so many football teams, companies, and countries, it might not be used to clarify anything that will make anyone safer. And the way that we bring clarity to hate crime response is just like, I think American civil rights law is a great example. And it has been working. If you are targeted because of your membership in a group, a faith group, by your race, by your gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or in some parts of the law, your membership in an ethnic group, an affinity group, which covers Jews, because there are some parts of the law that haven't formally included faith. If you are targeted because of your identity, in whatever form that takes, where a law has been broken, the government needs to protect you. And that's been working. Last May, I talked about how when the IDF is engaged with Hamas or any other conflation or that could be happening, violence against Jews goes up. When people who are angry at Israel walk away from a demonstration and throw water bottles into a kosher restaurant at Jewish people, I've never seen a government official confused about whether that was anti-Semitic, because that targeted Jews because of who they are. They have nothing to do with the IDF. They are just people who have a beard, keep kosher, and are eating dinner. And that's a crime. And the Equality Act in Britain and other really sound racial equality laws in Europe do the same thing. They look at which targeted group is covered. And that system works. And for a period of time in Europe, there was a gap. And all three of the definitions closed that gap. They said, hey, law enforcement, policymakers, university administrators, DEI departments and corporations, there's another kind of anti-Semitism, and it's a gap in our understanding now. All three of these definitions say hatred of Zionism or Israel or blaming Jews for the acts of Israel, that's targeting Jews because of who they are. So hello, your existing laws that work well, you need to be retrained just to recognize a new form. But that never needed to be put in law and policy. And that's why we have the controversy that we have. Just like Amal said, if you look at the examples, Amal sees reason to question the intent, right? I might say the intention isn't there, but when we write things that we want codified into law, we are responsible for looking at the impact, whatever the intent might be. And there have been some abuses of the impact. So I say, let's put these definitions back in training manuals. Let's debate these differences of opinions as the Jewish community is doing in a very raucous way. And let's not codify them into law. Someone just asked me in the Q&A, I'm looking in the chat or in the wrong chat feature. Did I mean to say that hatred of Zionism targets Jews? No. I am saying that in a practical situation, I'm not a scholar, I'm not a historian, I love scholars and historians, but I'm in the world of practitioners. And when a community coalition wants to include the Jewish community, if you make Zionism the bar, you are barring a very significant percentage of Jews. So in effect, you're asking Jews to jump through a hoop and renounce what for many Jews is part of their identity. So it's not making a judgment about Zionism. It would be like me saying, I will only admit anti-racism activists who are Black if they agree with, you know, the Democratic Party or progressive ideals. It means I'm shutting out a group of Black people in my coalition. So it's about, Sue, the practical implication of when you set a bar for admission that only will admit what we can agree is a very small percentage of Jewish people. So I say to that politician or coalition, your values of inclusion are not being met because of this litmus test. So litmus tests exclude people. I'm not a fan. Josh, do you want to look at some questions?
I spoke before you. So Amal, do you want to jump in for a couple minutes or should I jump into some questions first? Don't forget to unmute yourself and try to keep it as concise as possible.
Thank you. Very interesting questions. I think a lot to say about it. I'll start with an example why definitions are really problematic. In a speech or a video, short video issued by Benjamin Netanyahu a few weeks ago, he accused MK Mansour Abbas of being anti-Semitic, that he should not be partnered with, although he actually initiated the negotiations with him secretly and wanted him as an MK leading a political party to join his coalition. Recently, because his political interests have changed, he accused Mansour Abbas of being anti-Semitic. I think this is an ultimate example of how anti-Semitism is being exploited in order to delegitimize other people. And actually, at the same time, it's not only dismantling or delegitimizing other people, it's actually dismantling the right to legitimately use the anti-Semitism in order to fight anti-Semitism, real anti-Semitism. When you conflate so many ideas, so many manifestations of political positions or critique, phenomena, and so on and so on, as anti-Semitic, then actually you are the one who is violating or actually delegitimizing or somehow decomposing the ability to really fight against real anti-Semitic phenomena which exist. And I think Stacey brought examples. There are many examples to bring to show, yes, when you conflate certain things with inherent conceptualization of Jews or carry in the entire Jewish people as responsible for something, this is anti-Semitic, definitely. But this does not mean that any critique of any Jewish person or group doing something, such as in the case of Israel, is anti-Semitic. This can be. When we conflate these phenomena together, then it becomes really problematic. And one of the examples brought up in the questions is actually the nation state law in Israel. And before I tackle the issue of Zionism, the nation state of Israel, when you look at it, I wrote several articles about this law and was really pissed off by this law. Why? Because actually, it conflates the state of Israel with the entire Jewish people, leaving no space actually to differentiate between Jews and Israel, the policies of the Israeli state and the state itself. Closing the gaps between the phenomena and the state and its policies, as if any critique of the policy is critique of the state, or any critique of the policy of the state is actually delegitimizing the state. When you tell me that, then you leave me no space for freedom of expression. I have the right to criticize Zionism, yes. I'm not anti-Semitic, because for me, Zionism is actually, to give you priority, a person sitting now in Kiev or in Moscow or in New York, to tomorrow come to Israel and replace me or replace the right of my son for resources from the state in which I live for years. So I have. When the Israeli state or Zionism differentiates between or discriminates against me or conducts policies that violate the basic rights of Palestinians in which Jewish rights are defended, or in the name Jewish rights are defended, how do you want me to respect the definition of anti-Semitism in this case and not think there are some intentions behind the definition that may have been not, you know, the intentions of everybody involved in drafting the definition, but definitely people who know what definitions are maybe have the intentions there. So I think we have to be aware of this conflation of that Israel is doing, actually, that Zionist people in Israel are doing between Israel and the Jewish people. We cannot, you know, not hold them responsible for actually, not for anti-Semitic phenomena as a legitimate phenomenon, no, but the to reactions that are, you know, caused by being furious at this conflation, at trying to make me silent about certain things being done in Israel. And I think, as you said, Josh, this issue of Zionism and anti-Semitism, Israel and anti-Semitism, is the place, the most sensitive place that we have to tackle. And as long as we don't tackle this relationship and actually point out to our colleagues, our friends in Israel, as long as you are conflating the state of Israel and Zionism with Jewishness, then you are creating the problem. You are actually promoting certain patterns of anti-Semitism. It doesn't mean that people need this, you know, some people don't need actually this conflation in order to be anti-Semitic. We know there are people that use certain excuses in order to express their anti-Semitism. This has to be not tolerated, definitely. But it doesn't mean at the same time that the other side of the coin does not exist. And I think this is an issue I wanted to flag out in order to answer part of the questions that were raised before.
Thank you.
There are other questions, of course, to be tackled, but I'll
leave. Yeah. First of all, thank you. Thank you, Amal. Thank you to everyone who's chatting and questioning using both forums, because people like to talk, which is wonderful. I can't possibly address all of them. I've tried to answer a few as people, you know, double tasking. Let me just try to say a few things that will speak to many of the questions, some of the themes that came up, and also some things that Stacey and Amal just mentioned. First of all, I think my own positioning is somewhere between Stacey and Amal's on certain issue, which maybe is helpful as moderator. I think there's a lot of agreement in this platform anyway of the benefits of free speech, which has become Ken Stern's biggest campaign. And I think that's good to remember, to advocate free speech. I think we should remember that while we're arguing about the connection between anti-Semitism and Zionism, which I'll get to in a moment, which everyone's talking about in the chat, not to downplay actual unambivalent anti-Semitism, which is so prevalent, especially in the United States right now, that has nothing to do with Israel or Zionism. The conspiracy theory of Jewish power, of Jews controlling government and things like this, actual violent threats against Jews coming from the rise of Christian nationalism. Don't forget this, because it's actually quite prominent in the United States right now. And I'm just going to throw that out there. Once we have a definition of anti-Semitism, we're going to be called to Zionism, not only because of Israel, but because the idea of there being a single definition suggests a single Jewish peoplehood, which is already playing into the ideas of Zionism. So that's going to be inevitable. But I want to speak to two very important issues that I hope are helpful for everyone here. One of them, you know, a lot of defenders of IRA will often use, and not just them, will often use the phrase legitimate criticism of Israel. Now, what is that exactly, legitimate criticism of Israel? I often think of that joke of, you know, the famous Supreme Court case where the justice said, I don't know what pornography is, but I know it when I see it. And this wasn't it, right? And he declares some hardcore pornography film. It's not really pornography. It's okay. You don't have to censor it. Is it just in the eye of the beholder? I'd like to think it's not. I'd like to think we have some sense of what it is. And what I would argue is to understand Zionism as a symbol of, it could be Rothschild, and it could be Zionists, it could be international Jews, or Zionism as what Israel, the state, does or may be doing in practice. These need to be separated. I think Amal was trying to get to that. These need to be separated. Meaning to say, if somebody asking the questions, what if I'm against Zionists but not Jews? Well, what do you mean by I'm against Zionists but not Jews? Are you just saying Zionists in the sense of international Jews in another way? That's problematic. That's a problem. That's anti-Semitic. Are you saying Zionism in terms of Israel and what Israel has done to come into being? Because Israel has done things in being that are very troubling, right? Things that maybe were inevitable, other things that were not inevitable. In terms of a conflict between two peoples over the same land, right? So I think we need to separate these things very carefully. At the same time, and I'll speak more about that in a second. At the same time, let's not forget, Zionism is not just what Israel does. Zionism is also a form of Jewishness. I disagree with Amal about that. For many Jews, Zionism is what it means to be a Jew. It's a form of Judaism, if you will. It's a form, it's their identity. And it's actually in American discourse, often completely disconnected from what's actually happening in Israel-Palestine. And as we all know, it's often quite ignorant of what's happening in Israel-Palestine, right? So I think what we need to remember is a little sensitivity on both sides. People who want to critique anti-Zionism as being anti-Semitic, they have to remember that this is about a state. And frankly, for many of those people, their anti-Zionism is part of what it means to be who they are. But at the same time, people who want to be anti-Zionist need to remember that for many Jews, Zionism is their Jewishness. And while they're criticizing that state, they need to be very sensitive to the fact that it's not about the state for these people. It's about what it means to be a Jew, their pride, their ethnic pride, their religious pride, whatever you want to call it. And I think it's if we keep that in mind, it's a very helpful distinction. So for example, and again, anytime you're talking about a state or what a state may or may not be doing, that is, at least according to my understanding as a scholar and those of us who support the Jerusalem Declaration, that cannot be anti-Semitic. That is talking about an actual state, a country with power that responds to boycotts, right? A minority, you know, why was it anti-Semitic that the Nazis tried to boycott the Jews? Failed, by the way, at first. But it's not anti-Semitic, people will say, to boycott Israel. And the difference is because the Jews in Germany are not a collective organism that responds to boycotts and has power to exert that response, right? States are. States have governments and militaries and structures. They respond to boycotts. They respond to pressure. And it's not anti-Semitic to say so. Every state does. That's what comes with being a state, is that sovereign power. So there's a distinction there that we need to remember between Zionism as being a global Jewish conspiracy, a global Jewish organism, and Zionism meaning what it actually has been in practice. And I think if we keep that distinction in mind, it really speaks to, if not every chat and question, I think many of them. Keeping that in mind, but with the sensitivity to remember that many Zionists and anti-Zionists have this concept as an almost religious identity that should be treated sensitively. So that would be my response to many of the questions and chat comments, if it's helpful. And I'll respond, turn it back to Stacey now, I think.
Yeah, I agree with what you said, Josh. And I think, remember that when we talk about the fight against bigotry, whether it's racism or anti-Semitism, the purpose of the conversation, I think for all of us, and certainly for me as a practitioner, is to protect people, is to protect their rights. And so whether I agree with how someone interprets, right, as many participants as we have in this webinar, we have a different interpretation of their identity as either a non-Zionist Jew, a Zionist Jew. In the panelist chat, a lot of participants are putting in how they define their Zionism or someone else's Zionism, and they are all true for a large group of people. And so my duty as a practitioner in communities is to make sure people aren't excluded because of their membership in a group. And so I don't support Jewish community institutions who have litmus tests for participation by Jews based on whether they oppose BDS or are Zionists. They are members of my community. They are my family, and they are members of my family that I might disagree with on a question of how we self-identify. And I bet so many people on this webinar work in a lot of other communities who are dealing with challenges or debating their ideals, but people do have a right to self-identify, and they are all my family. And debating these definitions, I believe, has widened my own perspective about all the different people that I need to include and respect, even if they disagree with me about how they interpret their own identity. But I think it's even more of a reason not to put these definitions into law. How is the Montgomery County Council going to pass a resolution adopting this definition if the Jews in Montgomery County don't even agree on what Zionism is? And I'll take it a step back. Remember, if many of you do, when Whoopi Goldberg misidentified anti-Semitism and racism, because like a lot of people, she identifies racism with race, skin color. And she wasn't well-schooled and she wasn't aware of Nazi racial ideology, which of course considered Jews to be a different race. And this is confusing. You not only can you ask Zionists and non-Zionists how they self-identify and get different answers, ask anyone in your office or in your family what a Jew is, and you will hear a people, a faith, an ethnic group, you know. And so these sort of nuances of self-definition are a distraction from who we need to protect. So I want to just center us in the reality that when these definitions are put into policy or used by a university to punishing people or to triggering any kind of enforcement acts action based on these examples, we're in territory where this definition can be abused.
Thank you.
I think a few comments here are necessary. I think I clarified myself, and I think you, Josh, clarified certain things that are very important to put at the table, and therefore I'm not going to repeat them. The only thing I'm going to say is anti-Semitism. As you said, when you see it, you know it. I mean, anti-Semitism is, this bundling of all Jews or accusing Jews of being conspirative globally and having, you know, superpower abilities to do this and that. Definitely is anti-Semitic and shouldn't be legitimated in any way possible. On the other hand, we cannot ignore the political dimension of definitions. I think when we define a certain phenomena such as anti-Semitism, and actually there is political power behind it, trying to push states and institutions worldwide to adopt this definition, this specific definition, and then using this definition in order to delegitimize certain critique of Zionism or the State of Israel or the IDF and so on and so on, then actually this is the phenomena we have to speak about. This is the issue. The issue is not a discursive debate concerning the choice of words only in the definition, which is an issue, as I clarified before, but also the political usage made in order to promote this definition for political purposes, that at the end of the day, their goal is not to fight anti-Semitism, but actually to lead to delegitimizing certain critique, limiting freedom of expression, and silencing the ability of people to express their grievances, their critique and so on. I think we have, sticking to the definition itself and remaining there becomes problematic if we then carry on with how this definition is being manifested in real life. And it is manifested in a certain way in real life, and the efforts made, that the energies invested by, you know, certain people with certain political identity in order to promote this kind of definition, fighting against actually the Jerusalem definition. And we have to mention also this, the fact that people behind this broad definition have been very active in delegitimizing the alternative definition because it's more tolerant to critique of Israel or critique of Zionism and so on. So I think what I'm trying to point out is the politicization of certain definitions in order to reach certain political goals, the aim of which is actually silencing critique. Now, you said something very important regarding Zionism, and I see it as definitely legitimate way of defining legitimate as part of being Jewish. Definitely. I mean, this is for me, is completely fine, but again, it's for you. From the point of view of any Palestinian, okay, Zionism, the way it manifests itself vis-a-vis Palestinians, cannot be defined but the way it is. And the way it is practices of expansion, settlement, silencing, violating human rights, and so on and so on. The burden to prove that it's otherwise, Josh, is on the Zionist side. Okay? Historically, from the point of view of any victim of Zionism, the Palestinians in particular, Zionism has been actually the violating of their basic human rights. If you want to convince them, it's not. It's part of my Jewishness. The burden is on you to do so. Okay? And that's the same thing I say, tell my students at Tel Aviv University. It's criticizing Zionism does not automatically mean refuting or not accepting or manipulating against the right of Jews for self-determination. This right is there and should be recognized. I'm as a Palestinian say, okay, fine. But between this and Zionism, there's a huge gap that we have to tackle. And the burden to prove that Jewish self-determination does not mean automatically the violation of my basic rights. And not only that, but also trying to silence me to bear witness to the consequences of Zionist policies. This becomes a heavy load to deal with, especially when you utilize anti-Semitism in order to achieve this goal. I think this is the problem we have to tackle. The exploitation of anti-Zionism in order to silence how victims experience Zionism. And if you want them to experience Zionism as part of Jewishness, and I fully understand those who aspire to do so, we have to be aware together because I believe we are in the same boat in this regard, in the sense that we have to work hard to reach a place where we avoid giving people who are anti-Semitic or racist, and of course bigotry in general, to give them the chance to exploit, to use double standards, to exploit double standarding in order to achieve what they want. We have to work together on this. But at the same time, we have to work together also on the other effort of preventing people from exploiting the definition of anti-Semitism in order to bypass certain critique or silence certain critique, which is legitimate vis-a-vis the reality in which they live. When we join forces in order to achieve this goal, I think we can be active in the United States, in Europe, as well as in Israel, Palestine, in order to achieve the same goal. And that is being open about what exactly is happening, how we can tackle what's happening in order to prevent the violation of basic human rights, no matter whether they are human rights of Jews or of Palestinians.
I think Ron unmuting his video was a hint, like the case for all of us. I wanted to say real quickly, first of all, thank you both for...
I think everybody should can take some time to do like a quick wrap up and then, yeah.
First of all, let me just say, I've loved the fact that we've been having simultaneous conversations, both in video and online, and the idea of limiting ourselves to Q&A. Now, everyone decided to just forget about that. We're gonna use both options because we need more time to converse. There's been some really great comments. Let me just clarify about the issue of Zionism as identity. I just wanna clarify for the moment. First of all, those who know me know that that is actually not my own particular Judaism. I don't wanna get too personal, but my Judaism is based on other texts and other traditions and not those. But I've been studying this for some 35, 30 years now. So I do think it's important to understand Zionism for what it is and for what it isn't. But above all, I would say two things walking away. First of all, I think it's very important when we're talking about anti-Semitism and Israel or anti-Zionism and so on, to separate what the state is doing from any kind of global conspiracy. I think if we keep that in mind, that will answer such a large percentage of the debate, that if we are talking about a global conspiracy of some sense, and you're talking about Israel as being the head of that conspiracy, I don't even like the phrase a friend of mine on Facebook once said, don't call it crossing the line. It's not crossing the line. It's a totally different phenomenon than anti-Israel criticism. And I think he's right. It's not the same thing. To use Israel instead of Rothschild is not anti-Israel. It's just anti-Semitic. And if we're talking about a state and what a state has done or you think it's done, you could be right, you could be wrong, but it's not about anti-Semitism. I will say that. And I'll say that one of the things that I think we seem to agree on, I don't know if everyone in the audience does, there's a famous quote about Kabbalah by, I think it was Lieberman, who said that nonsense is nonsense, but the study of nonsense is science. And I feel like, you know, all of us have these hesitations about these definitions. I know I certainly do. Conversation about the definitions, that can be productive maybe and help us tease out these things. I think Stacy was getting at that earlier. So I echo that sense very much, that the conversation, even if the definitions are highly problematic, and I think the Jerusalem one, by the way, even though I signed it, is all problematic in its own ways. The conversation, though, is productive. And I thank you all for coming. And I'll turn over to Stacy and Amal if they want to say any last words before Ron wraps us up.
No, I agree with a lot of what you said in your last comments, Amal. And I think we have to remember that behind these ideological labels are people, right? One of the comments was, you know, Zionism is the same as white nationalism. I think that's not a good starting point for really delving into these issues with respect to the commenter. I think what you said is exactly, I say it in the same way. I'm a Zionist. I shouldn't be excluded from public spaces. I fight racism. Anti-Semitism is integral to white nationalism. But I can be in a civic space with Amal and understand that the Zionist movement has led to the creation of a state, and some of those policies are having a negative impact on communities. The same way I still love the United States, and too many of, you know, our policies have a negative impact on communities. So I think once we realize behind these labels are people, and people of goodwill who do not want their narrative and ideology to erase anyone else's rights or their narrative. So I think that's what is productive in these conversations. And I also think that the conversations around these definitions have brought me together with people who I really feel such a strong affinity for. And I feel like hopefully at the end of this, we'll be part of each other's shared future and a civic space where we can debate these issues of ideology with a love of people who are impacted by these policies. So thank you.
Amal, did you want to say anything else, or should we turn it back to Ron?
I don't know if we have the time, but one of the issues that came to mind when I was reading the definition and the examples given is that actually denying, I said, of course, before about self-determination of the Jewish people and so on, or at least Jewish people in Israel, the definition includes, denying the Jewish right for self-determination is anti-Semitic, then actually, made me think that actually most Israeli Jews deny the Palestinian right for self-determination, and the Palestinians are a Semitic people, so they must be anti-Semitic too.
I don't know if we want to go into the history of the word anti-Semitism. We know it was a German construction, so I don't know if we want to go there.
I don't want to open the bundle one more time, but I want
that's
to...
That's another webinar.
The definition is such an... It contains absurd issues that I think make this discussion very legitimate and should be continued, of course, in other contexts.
Yeah, thank you. Ron, the floor is yours.
Wow, thank you. Thank you, Stacy and Amal, and Joshua. This is terrific. My Jewishness, if I could have a word, starts with the first Hebrew, Avram and his smashing of the idols. And I'm not saying that we should smash the IRA definition, but we should hold it up to the light. And that's what we were trying to do today. You know, we don't idolize things. This is a human construct, IRA is, and maybe it gets some things right and maybe wrong, but what we can't do is say, that's it, all, you know, all received wisdom is done. And we had a great panel who were challenging it and questioning it and citing what was good and what was bad. And I really, really appreciate that. So very quickly, before everybody leaves us, thank you to the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for making this happen, to our panelists again. I'll again say thank you. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want more, go to progressiveisrael.org, make your way to the donation page, because these things don't happen of themselves. And you remember that. For those who missed the opening about program notes, very quickly, Israel-Palestine Symposium starting October 23, running for 7 Sundays until December 18th. Keep an eye out. Keep an eye out for a webinar on Hashem Eretz Yair and their relief efforts for Ukrainian refugees. And in September, a webinar with representatives of the Land for All and the Holy Land Confederation about varying approaches to a potential Israel-Palestine confederation. That's it. Stay safe, everyone. Most of all, stay informed, and see you next time. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.